Welcome to the Legal Aid New South Wales Criminal Law Division podcast. The Criminal Law Division of Legal Aid New South Wales acknowledges the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the traditional custodians of the land and waters. We acknowledge this podcast is recorded on Aboriginal land and pay our respect to elders past and present. We extend that respect to First Nations listeners joining us here today.
Welcome everyone to episode 5 of the 5 Cases podcast. I'm Caitlin Akhtar from Forbes Chambers and I'm speaking to you from Gadigal land. It's the 23rd of November 2023 and I'm here with Sophie Anderson who's joining us from Bundjalung country on the North Coast. Sophie, what are your cases on this episode about?
Hi Caitlin and hi everyone who's out there listening. So yeah, let's dive right in. The first two cases that I have today are one on committals and the EAGP process and the powers within Section 67 of the Criminal Procedure Act. That's the decision of Elwood and the DPP, 2023 New South Wales Supreme Court 772. And the second case I'm looking at is the beleaguered and work-generating EAGP process in the decision of Tuxford and the DPP, 2023 New South Wales Supreme Court 1300. How about you, Caitlin? What have you got for us today?
So today I'm going to talk about three completely unrelated cases. The first is R and DK, 2023, New South Wales CCA 281, and the curious case of a range of solicitors being subpoenaed to produce documents from client files. Hot off the High Court Press, McNamara and the King, 2023, HCA 36, is about the limits to how much shade you can throw at your co-accused in a joint trial. And finally, I'll also look at a case of a defendant in the local court being awarded $47,000 of costs following the withdrawal of a single fine-only offence in R, New South Wales Police, and Main Freight Pty Ltd., 2023 NSWDC 459. Sophie, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, great. I'm very keen to hear about that last one. So just starting us off with the decision of Elwood. This is a decision that was handed down from the Supreme Court on the 14th of July 2023, so some months ago. But the reason why I'm mentioning it today is because it's still obviously very relevant, and there's been a more recent decision from the Supreme Court on the 18th of October, which we were going to mention, but we realised had been subject or will be subject to a suppression order. So for those of you who are interested in that and to go find that little breadcrumb, I'm sure you will. But the point is that it's an interesting area of law. It's good to look at what the Supreme Court has been doing on that. So this is a decision from the Supreme Court in the Common Law Division. That means that the court was hearing the appeal as a judicial review from the findings made by a magistrate in the local court. In that situation, the accused person who is bringing the action is known on the appeal as a plaintiff, of course. Essentially, they are the plaintiff because they are seeking relief from an inferior court. So in this case, the plaintiff was represented throughout, and basically the facts are that the plaintiff was initially charged with 29 separate offences. 9 months later, a complete brief was served and a charge certificate was filed. The matter had been adjourned for a significant period of time, and effectively it proceeded really slowly through the local court, even for a committal matter. And when it got to the year point in time, or it had been in the list for a year, the case conference certificate still hadn't been filed. The plaintiff and the prosecution at that juncture both jointly agreed that no case conference certificate had been filed and there were new charges and negotiations were ongoing. Both parties then made an application to the sitting magistrate to adjourn the matter on the basis that the plaintiff couldn't confirm any pleas would be entered at that time. The magistrate was obviously quite concerned with the delay in the proceedings and ultimately refused the application for the adjournment, entered pleas of not guilty on behalf of the accused or the plaintiff in the Supreme Court proceedings, and then committed the matter for trial, finding that the plaintiff had unreasonably failed to file a case conference certificate contrary to Section 76 of the Criminal Procedure Act. The appeal court went through in detail the relevant provisions and Section 76 and drew out a number of distinctions, ultimately allowing the appeal and setting aside the magistrate's order and remitting it to the local court for decision by another magistrate. But what the Court of Appeal looked at was Section 76.3, which provides that an accused person's legal representative, where they have unreasonably failed to participate in a case conference or file a case conference certificate, then the magistrate can commit the accused for trial or sentence if the case conference is not required. Or there's also a power to adjourn in that section. The court looked at Section 76, subsection 2, which is about where a prosecutor has unreasonably failed to do something and then what the powers of the magistrate are, which is to discharge or adjourn. Also, Section 76, subsection 4, which is where action is taken under 76, what the magistrate must do is always consider the interests of justice in applying the provisions of that section. So the other relevant section was Section 70, subsection 5, which referred to the fact that more than one case conference can be held. Sorry, the court found that the magistrate, for various reasons, was in error and focused on what the provisions in 76 are there to do, and that is not just simply to consider delay or the failure to participate in a case conference or, in fact, to complete a certificate. What the court says is that delay will frequently be the cause of failure, but not necessarily so, and that even where there is long delay, there really needs to be a consideration of the interests of justice, and that when considering whether or not there's been unreasonable failure to participate in a case conference, look at the actual details of what transpired.
Wow, okay. So that sounds like a pretty comprehensive review of 76. What would you say is the main takeaway from it?
Well, I think that it confirms a number of things, and that's largely that the role of the local court in committal proceedings is really now largely administrative. It doesn't have a lot of powers. I guess with the powers that it does have, then it really needs to consider the operation of those powers, looking through the lens of the interests of justice. And in this case, you can see that both parties were actually working towards a resolution. Clearly, there was evidence of that, and that's an important consideration that obviously the magistrate was said to have failed to do in those proceedings. The other thing is that delay can be a factor, but it can be caused by lots of reasons, as we all have probably experienced, and that it's very important that the overarching theme of these proceedings is the interests of justice.
Okay, that's really interesting. I'm also interested in the cases that have been coming out about where a plea of guilty is entered during the EAGP process, you know, how the discounts applied. So I think, if I understand correctly, that Tuxford is a case about that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I thought I'd actually refer to it because the EAGP process is obviously, as I said, work generating for not only us as lawyers but also the court. And so that decision does look at exactly that situation where a plea of guilty has been entered during the EAGP process. Again, that's a decision where the court was constituted by a single judge sitting in the common law division. So it's a review power, and it's a review of what a local court magistrate did. It's interesting because, again, it deals with the role of a magistrate in the proceedings. It really amplifies the one thing that a magistrate must actually do, and that is that the magistrate must inquire about whether or not the accused is wishing to plead guilty to anything before committal. So just briefly, the facts in that case were that the plaintiff was charged with an aggravated sexual assault offence or allegation contrary to Section 61J. The plaintiff appealed to the Supreme Court Common Law Division on the basis that the magistrate had erred in failing to ascertain whether or not the plaintiff was pleading guilty. And the court allowed the appeal, setting aside the committal order, and then remitted the matter to the local court following the decision that some of you may already be aware of Coles and the DPP, which is 2022 New South Wales Supreme Court 960, where it referred to some of those powers at paragraph 26. So what this looked at was section 95, subsection 4 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which provides that before committing an accused person under section 95, a magistrate must ascertain whether or not a plea of guilty to the offences is to be proceeded with. This is mandatory, and the court said at paragraph 13 of Tuxford that it's mandatory for good practical reasons. So the evidence disclosed on this decision indicated that the plaintiff's solicitor had been served with additional material and that discussions were ongoing, and that it was likely that the plaintiff was going to plead guilty to an appropriate charge with amended facts. So the court did remit the matter so that a plea of guilty could actually be entered before the magistrate, thereby ensuring that the plaintiff wasn't deprived of the 25% discount for the plea of guilty, which the plaintiff would have been entitled to. And again, just following up on some different decisions in that area, but particularly that decision of Coles. Interestingly, in this case, the magistrate appears to have committed the matter again out of some form of concern about the delay in the process. It was over the objection of the DPP, and really, as I say, the parties had forecast that there were still ongoing negotiations being undertaken. So that decision came down in October following the other decision that I was referring to, that it's been likely to be suppressed. But the succession of these decisions this year generally is quite interesting in terms of clarification of the EAGP process, which can cause reasonable minds to differ about the interpretation of that. And I would just recommend everyone go back and read Coles to assist as well.
That sounds really interesting. I think kind of close attention to the specific provisions in terms of the sections that deal with the EAGP process sounds like it's going to be really important. So is there anything else that you think that we should look at kind of in this area to guide us with the EAGP process?
Yeah, look, I think that this decision of Tuxford's quite interesting in terms of, you know, a line in the sand being drawn about what a magistrate must do. And so it's interesting for that reason. But can I also recommend to everybody the paper by Richard Wilson, senior counsel, who is the senior public defender, about the EAG process and the traps and the tricks, as he refers to, because it's available on their website and it walks you through all the different permutations that can happen through the EAGP process, and it's really worth a read. Now, Caitlin, over to you.
Great. Well, I think I'll start with the High Court case because it's a really interesting case that maybe a lot of people would be aware of. But that's the High Court's decision in McNamara and the King. So that's 2023 HCA 36. So it's the High Court's decision on the widely publicised murder trial of former police officers Roger Rogerson and Glenn McNamara. And those two were convicted of murdering Jamie Gow, who was, relevantly to this case, a drug supplier. McNamara's defence was duress. His case was that Rogerson had threatened him that if he didn't assist Rogerson to move the body of Mr Gow, and he said to him, "I did Drury and I'll do you too." And it was McNamara's case that Drury was a reference to Michael Drury, who is a police officer who was shot. McNamara had also wanted to adduce evidence of an earlier conversation he says occurred where Rogerson had admitted to shooting Drury and also had admitted to murdering another two people and arranging a further two murders. So Rogerson objected to this evidence and it was excluded at their joint trial under section 135A. As it was unfairly prejudicial to a party to the proceedings. But on appeal to the High Court, McNamara said that 135A did not apply because Rogerson wasn't a party to McNamara's proceedings, even though it was a joint trial. Now, I just wander off a bit to say there's some really important points in this decision about relying on assumptions about what we think fundamental principles of criminal trials are, but I'll resist that temptation to go on a frolic about that, and I'll just encourage all the law nerds amongst us to go and read that case in full. But essentially, the High Court held that each co-accused is a party to the one proceeding if they're in a joint trial, and so 135A was a valid way to exclude that evidence that McNamara had wanted to adduce, and they've dismissed McNamara's appeal.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I really encourage you to go and read it, as I say, in full. I think it's really interesting. And there's a lot of interlocutory judgments from the trial which analyse various sections of the Evidence Act in a really informative and interesting way. So I would also encourage people to go and have a look at that if they're interested.
Yes.
So the next case is hopefully one that might give some practical guidance to practitioners. It's R and DK 2023 New South Wales CCA 281. And DK considers whether the district court can order costs when a solicitor is subpoenaed by the Crown to produce documents. But spoiler alert, it can't. In DK, the Crown issued subpoenas on a number of lawyers and a barrister. Those practitioners did not act for the accused, DK, by the time they were subpoenaed. Each subpoena was resisted by the legal practitioners on the basis that the documents required to be produced under the subpoena were the subject of legal professional privilege. And it was accepted that the subpoenas were not an abusive process in the context of the particular proceedings that they were issued in. The district court ordered that the Crown pay reasonable costs to each legal practitioner, and it was a bit unclear whether that was the costs of complying with the subpoena or for the cost of attempting to resist production under the subpoena. But in either case, the Crown appealed to the Court of Criminal Appeal and the CCA held, firstly, that the district court did not have the power to award costs against the Crown. Secondly, the privilege was not the practitioners to claim, it was the clients. And thirdly, that practitioners were compelled to do no more than produce the documents to the court and to indicate that the client may wish to claim privilege over them.
Yeah, right. And so, I mean, that makes sense to me in many respects. Were there any other takeaways from that?
I guess it's just a helpful case in making really clear step by step what you and I should do if we're ever issued with such a subpoena, hopefully not. The process, if you're issued with a subpoena like this, is to firstly notify your previous client that you've received it, secondly produce the documents to court but indicate on production that they might be the subject of a claim of legal privilege, and of course the other important takeaway is that you aren't entitled to costs if you're subpoenaed for the Crown.
Yeah, interesting.
There's just no power.
Some good practical tips there for us. And so what's your last case?
Well, this one I hope is also going to be practical for people. It's a costs case. So R, which is New South Wales Police, and Main Freight Proprietary Limited, and the citation's 2023 NSWDC 459. Main Freight considers an order by a local court magistrate for New South Wales Police to pay initially more than $85,000 in costs following the withdrawal of a criminal charge. So it never went to hearing.
Wow.
Police had charged Main Freight with an offence against the heavy vehicle national law. That offence had a maximum penalty of $10,000. The offence was a strict liability offence. Police were not required to serve a brief and they didn't do so. They did not obtain evidence from the drivers of the vehicles and they didn't use available powers to require Main Freight to provide information relevant to the offence charged. You might think they didn't need to prove much, but even in the context of not having to prove much, they really did very little investigation at all. The police withdrew the matter on the day of the hearing. Main Freight sought costs of more than $85,000 under Section 214C of the Criminal Procedure Act on the basis that police unreasonably failed to investigate the matter. Police contended that they did not unreasonably fail to investigate. They said they did not have to interview every available witness and there was no basis to order costs. And then they also said that the $85,000 was unreasonable. After that cost order was made, police appealed that cost decision to the district court. The district court found that the police had unreasonably failed to investigate the matter and that costs were warranted, but the court also found the magistrate didn't have sufficient evidentiary basis to find that the costs were just and reasonable, which is the test.
Since
they were not agreed between the parties and no itemised bill or chronology was provided. On appeal, the costs were reduced to just over $47,000, which is still, you might think, a pretty substantial sum of money.
Yeah, a bit of a haircut, but you'd still be happy, wouldn't you?
I think so. And so I think what we need to take away from this is the extent to which police are required to investigate in terms of this provision for awarding costs about an unreasonable failure to investigate. That'll depend on the individual matter, but here I think it's worth noting that the costs were warranted even for a strict liability offence. So it's worth considering and when you're thinking about whether to seek costs in your case and whether the police have unreasonably failed to investigate. The second thing I'd probably say is it's important to have an evidentiary basis to support a finding that the amount you seek is just and reasonable. And in this case, even though the defendant was willing to spend much more than the maximum penalty on representation, even the district court on appeal found that this was just and reasonable. So I think that's definitely something to keep in mind. And the third thing I thought was quite interesting was that Maine Freight were compensated for the cost of having to obtain the evidence against them under subpoena because the police didn't provide a brief, even though police weren't required to provide a brief. So there's no issue about whether the police had done the wrong thing. But even so, Maine Freight were entitled to be compensated for the costs that they were put to because of that.
Oh, fascinating. And, of course, costs being a very interesting area of law but pretty difficult to get, it sounds like it's a really good decision to sort of underline those rare circumstances under 2141C.
Yeah, I definitely think so. So, look, those are my cases and that's all we have time for today. I just wanted to say that we're really grateful to Matthew Dimmick and Legal Aid for giving us a platform for the podcast. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll have some additional things in store for you all in the new year.
Hopefully that will also include better recording quality, and thanks to all our listeners for just bearing with us while we sort of work out our own tech issues. But you can find the Five Cases podcast on the Legal Aid Division Criminal Law Division channel on all podcast services. And please remember that we can be contacted via email at fivecasespodcast@gmail.com. We would love your feedback and any suggestions on topics or cases that you'd like us to cover and hopefully help you in your own practices. Thanks so much.
Bye, everyone.